I'm not trying to take credit for it, but I think it was one of the first guys to ever tell a reporter, hey, you know, one almond is a gallon of water. I wish I'd never said that now, because people are like, well, almonds are evil. Well, one cantaloupe is 60 gallons of water. You know, a bottle of wine is 275 gallons of water. I'm sort of young for being a farmer. I'm 46, you know. I've never seen so many guys so stressed out, and they're looking around going, you know, where the hell am I going to get a job?
Central Valley almond farmer Sean Coburn says he may have to quit farming if he doesn't get more water soon. We'll hear more from him later on in the show. First, though, the Los Angeles Unified School District has an iPad, or $43,000, it would like to sell you. Lawyers for the district have fired off a letter to Apple saying they're not happy with the product. Not the iPads themselves, it's the software on them. School officials say the curriculum on the iPads made by the education company Pearson is glitchy, and students don't really like the content. They say most teachers who were given the iPads have stopped trying to use Pearson's app. The iPad debacle led to the end of John Daisy's tenure as superintendent, and the FBI is investigating possible fraud in the bidding process. Joining us on the line now is Steve Zimmer. He's a board member at the LAUSD. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Mel, and good to be back.
Nice to have you. And also Howard Bloom, education reporter at the LA Times. Welcome back, Howard.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with you, Steve Zimmer, and tell us more about what's in this letter that the district sent to Apple.
Well, the basic part of this letter, and as you just said, there's a lot of complications. There's a lot of things going on with the whole, what we now call iPad gate, and everything that's happened around it. This part is actually remarkably simple. Whatever flaws were in the contract, it was very, very simple that there was a deliverable, which was a K through 12 Common Core aligned content that could be used on the iPad, that could be used by teachers. And what we have learned, and what is very, very clear, is that product was never satisfactorily delivered. As a matter of fact, only two out of the 55 schools that actually executed, you know, that had that we fulfilled the contract of getting the actual iPads to our kids. Only two out of the 55 are actually using or trying to use anymore the Pearson content.
So what's wrong with it? What's wrong with the content?
It very, very simply, it's not good. It's not easy to use. It's not Common Core aligned. It's not curricularly satisfactory. It doesn't even meet the baseline standards of what we would need it to do. I mean, the whole point of this project, when we first started, was to was to bridge the digital divide. And it's something that I still stand by, even though everything that happened after that was frankly disastrous.
Right. And you voted for this in the first place, along with, you know, obviously the majority of the board. And you didn't get a glimpse of what was going to be the content before you voted for it?
We got a glimpse. And I've said this publicly, and I'll continue to say this. This is the worst vote I ever took as a policymaker. I extended far too much trust, both to the folks within the district who were telling us that this was the right contract and would execute our goals, but also to Apple and Pearson. We got a glimpse, and as is often the case with, like, for example, for a trailer, to a movie, we saw a lot of things that looked looked fairly promising. And we trusted far too much.
And how much money did you spend?
So it's in the millions and millions of dollars. One of the complications in the tens and tens of millions of dollars, one of the complications to this is that the Apple and Pearson contract are together. So it's very hard for us we have to get through Apple to get to Pearson, essentially.
Right. Okay, so Howard Bloom, you've been following this. And where does the fault lie? Does it lie with Pearson in not providing the product that it promised?
Well, certainly the district is not happy with the product, and it has never delivered to its promise. But the district bought the product sight unseen, essentially, because they wanted to bundle the price of the curriculum with the price of the iPad, because there's this legal argument that goes, if you bundle them into the same purchase price, you can use school construction bonds, which can be used to purchase technology, to buy the whole kit and caboodle. If you buy the curriculum later, it's not as clear that you can use school construction bonds to pay for it. So there is this tremendous pressure to move quickly and to bundle it all into one price. And there's no curriculum to look at, just a few samples. And the district staff went with the evaluation team went with Pearson. They recommended Pearson to the board. In fact, among the finalists, Pearson was the only choice given to the Board of Education. So the board didn't have much choice if it wanted to move forward. But as I think Steve Zimmer has acknowledged, they also did not happen to ask a lot of questions that might have elicited some of this information.
Right. So, Steve, you didn't, when this all came up for a vote, you didn't think, or people on the board didn't think to say, is there another curriculum out there that we could look at? Why do we have to be rushed into choosing this one?
There were actually a lot of questions asked. And there was, I mean, again, as a board member, there are, not to make excuses, I already said, I mean, I take responsibility for, you know, for this contract, and have a lot of regret about the contract. But we did ask a lot of questions. We are not at the highest level of digital content experts, and we did accept that this was the best product. And but all of that, you know, all the questions around that being legitimate, it was never satisfactorily delivered. The kids aren't able to use that, and that is undisputed. And so if I'm Pearson or I'm Apple and I want to do this around the country, to me, they should take some responsibility and fix this problem. The way to fix it right now is simply, you know, to give the taxpayers their money back and let us, again, help kids to bridge this digital divide so that all kids in Los Angeles have access to technology, have access to the latest ways to get at curriculum in new and creative ways, which was our goal in the first place.
Okay. So what now? Has Apple responded to this letter at all, or is it too soon?
No, they we have not yet received a response. But this is really, you know, a decisive moment. Apple and Pearson have a moment in which they could be, you know, decent corporate sponsor, you know, partners to LA Unified and some of the kids who need this more than any other kids in the nation, and really, you know, be responsible and say, hey, we weren't able to deliver. Here's your taxpayer money back because we couldn't execute this contract.
Well, I guess they're going to argue that they did execute the contract, and you should have read the fine print, and you know.
Yeah, but this is about kids. And what's undisputed is what has been delivered is not usable. Kids are not bridging the digital divide. Kids don't have access. And while, again, I take responsibility as a policymaker for having too much trust in John Daisy and his administration, at the end of the day, even with that, the product was not satisfactorily delivered.
Okay, so what does this mean for the whole idea of bringing technology into the classroom? Does this mean we just start over? We're at zero now?
No, we have to be as committed to this as we ever were. What it means is that our corporate sponsors, our corporate partners who are making much money off the back of our kids, have got to come together in a way that says, you know, this is an issue of equity and social justice beyond profit, and to make sure collectively as a corporate and public community that for kids who cannot access this by their own means, that if their only means to access this is through the public education system, then we all have to come together in a way that looks at this way beyond profit and competition and how do we get the best product to the kids who need it the most. That's what needs to happen now.
Okay. And Howard, finally with you, there is an ongoing FBI investigation into how this happened in the first place and if the bid process was rigged in any way. What's happening with that?
Not much that we know about. We know that the FBI received boxes and boxes, or seized, obtained, however you want to word it, lots of boxes from the district. They've cataloged those materials, And these investigations can persist for years, and we don't know that anything will come of it. And, you know, there's a lot of room for mistakes to be made that fall short of criminal liability here. So they're interested in criminal liability. The rest of us are interested in kind of figuring out what happened, whether it was a crime or not.
Howard Bloom, education reporter for the LA Times. Steve Zimmer, LAUSD board member. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The website that provides hand-knitted tea cozies to the world went public yesterday and began trading today. The online craft marketplace Etsy was offered at $16 a share, and it's already going for around twice that, making the company worth more than $3 billion. That is a lot of beaded bracelets. Telos Demos is here now. He's been following the IPO for the Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. So what made the people at Etsy think it was time to go public?
This is a company that was started with venture capital backing, and like all kind of venture capital-backed companies, eventually they've got to sort of pay back those guys, and that's typically either selling the company or going public. And this has been a pretty strong market for, you know, any kind of technology company, and, e-commerce companies have, a number of them have gone public over the last couple of years. We saw Alibaba, obviously, the gigantic Chinese e-commerce company. We've seen others here in the U.S., like Zulily, Wayfair, which operates the flash sale site Joss & Main. So it seemed like, you know, the zeitgeist at the moment is that, you know, people want to own, companies that are selling stuff online, using mobile apps to kind of build audiences and things like that. So it was the right time for them.
And the company set aside 5% of its shares to sell to vendors and other small investors. Was that unusual for it to do that?
It's been seen before where companies have set aside, you know, a slice of the IPO for, you know, their customers or kind of friends of the company and things like that. What was unusual, though, is the degree to which Etsy actually went out to actually find those people. Unlike most companies who, you know, only go to New York and San Francisco and Boston to talk to, like, big money managers, Etsy actually went to, you know, they really went on the road, and the CEO and the CFO, you know, traveled to Cleveland, Milwaukee, Rockford, Illinois, Paramus, New Jersey, cities like that where, you know, they feel like there are clusters of people who are Etsy vendors. They kind of focused on, cities that have, you know, sort of, you know, maybe slightly depressed economies, and people are, you know, trying to make a living by selling stuff on Etsy. So they actually went out, they pitched it to, you know, brokers who work in those cities, and they also put a cap on the number of shares that people could get, on the number that small investors could get. You know, most companies, when they sell their IPOs to so-called retail investors, that usually means, like, very wealthy, you know, families and stuff like that. This was, you know, they genuinely wanted to sell 150 shares for $2,500 or less to as many people as they could. So, you know, they ended up selling the deal to, I'm not sure exactly, but it might have been, you know, 16, you know, between 15 and 20,000 accounts potentially, of, you know, kind of small investors. And that's very unusual for a company.
So it wasn't just a PR stunt to make it look like it was still an authentic, you know, homegrown company.
Well, it remains to be seen whether people will still see it that way. You know, being a public company, no matter how you kind of distribute your stock or, you know, the promises that you make about your business principles, there come certain pressures with that. You know, shareholders will be, you know, vicious at times, and they will, you know, if you miss a quarter or if you, you know, if Etsy decides to not do something that it would be profitable but doesn't fit its values, you know, what will investors say to that? So, you know, I think what Etsy has tried to do is kind of build a little moat around itself by picking investors who are either, you know, people who really work with the company, who use it as sellers, or like kind of big investors who say they really get it and they get that they're thinking for the long term and they're not so focused on quarter to quarter. But we've seen other companies. Google famously said, you know, their motto was don't be evil when they went public. You know, some people kind of throw that in their face every time they do something that they don't like, every time they, you know, kind of, you know, get in trouble for privacy issues and things like that, say, hey, that seems evil to me. So I think Etsy will always be and wants to be held to a higher standard. That may work out. That may get it in trouble.
Yeah. Well, so it needs to still have this image of being homemade and homespun, selling, what, like cane toed leather coin purses and stuff like that. How can it do that,
chair
though?
Chair socks. I know my chair was very cold during this long winter in New York. So,
but seriously, now that it is a public company and it's valued now at $3 billion, it Does it change the way it operates in that sense?
Well, I mean, the company needs to grow, and they've you know, they haven't been shy about, you know, they have ambitions to be a bigger company. They're you know, spending more money to kind of promote products and sellers, you know, with targeted ads and stuff like that on the web. So in order to get bigger, they need to broaden their audience. So, you know, the people who maybe, you know, maybe way when Etsy started were, you know, the first adopters, you know, who really wanted to, you know, have a retail experience that was totally different from, you know, buying in a big box store and stuff like that. Those people might not recognize the Etsy that they started with, but, you know, Etsy needs it doesn't want to see itself as a niche player focusing just on those people. And they've made some moves over the past few years, which, you know, have probably alienated some of those early adopters. You know, they allow some people to sell manufactured goods. Now, they're pretty strict about what you can do, and they try and make sure that it's not just, like, mass-produced junk. But, you know, just even allowing anything like that, you know, kind of certainly upset some people. And, you know, so it's not hard to find people who feel like Etsy's, you know, kind of shied away from its mission. But, you know, they want to be a place where everyone in the world goes to find weird stuff, you know. So on those days when you need, illuminated, you know, chickens, you know, that's, you know, to go to Etsy for that.
Every day is a day for that.
Sure.
We need one of those. Well, tell us, who are Etsy's 1.4 million sellers? That's a lot. It's not just, you know, 30-year-old women selling cat barrettes.
No. It's like I said, you know, they've broadened their network to, you know, people who you know, really make a living doing this, you know. So I think it's people who sell, you know, kind of, you know, handmade sort of, you know, kind of consumer goods and things like that, you know, like, you know, it may be beauty products, you know, it might be, certainly there's a lot of people who sell clothing. And a big part of Etsy is also vintage. They make a big point that not everything is sort of craft and stuff like that. It's also people who go out and, you know, kind of find, you know, kind of vintage items and things like that. And that's a huge market. You know, I'm sure, you know, hipsters everywhere, you know, need kind of, you know, ironic old T-shirts and things like that. So they've certainly tapped into, you know, more than just kind of the homemade stuff and made it possible to have, you know, sort of like a kind of almost a consignment business via Etsy, you know. And again, it aims to be a little more curated than an eBay, which is a bit more of a free-for-all. But certainly, like, it's the audience has widened a lot beyond just, you know, somebody making weird stuff.
Talos Demos, he lovingly crafts his stories by hand for the Wall Street Journal. I couldn't resist.
Thanks
Talos. Well, what is the craziest thing you've ever seen or bought on Etsy? We want to know. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we may use your comment later on in the show. Coming up, how does a politician appear cool on social media? Well, if you have to ask, we'll talk about that. And why scientists are mad at Roomba with Shani Jardin. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hillary Clinton skipped the soaring speech in front of a historic landmark when she announced her candidacy this week. She went the chill route. A polished video slipped to the social media masses. She is, of course, no stranger to viral culture. Clinton starred in her very own meme for a minute. You may recall the Hillary Clinton texting meme from a few years back. Well, now she uses that as her picture on Twitter, of course. It is just some kind of weird Mobius strip. We're going to talk about all of this with Shani Jardin at boingboing.net. If politicians can be cool online, or is it just accidental?
We will find out over the next year, I suppose. You know, the Hillary Clinton texting meme is a great example of a kind of a recursive, ironic awareness that savvy politicians and their teams develop. So in this case, you had a meme that was created by people other than Hillary Clinton, then it was co-opted by Hillary Clinton's social media staff.
This is her looking at her phone.
Looking at her phone while
with
texting
her sunglasses on
a plane, right?
Yeah,
on
she looked so
Air
cool.
Force, whatever.
Yeah.
Memes that are really good can be recycled in endless ways.
Right. Then there is the unfortunate Marco Rubio drinking water meme when he gave the response to, I think it was the 2013 State of the Union address, and he was the Republican response.
God love him. Marco Rubio.
He reaches over, grabs a little Poland Spring, I think, gulp of water while still looking into the camera, and then that becomes a thing.
Imagine if the ability to make reaction GIFs out of those awkward moments, imagine if that were around when Nixon was our president. Imagine a cold, awkward TV type being just sliced and diced like so many Ronco food processor commercials into meme oblivion.
Well, I imagine now these candidates have people on their staff who try to cultivate this audience.
Hell yeah, they do. I think that you think about how media management for politicians was in the 80s, in the 90s, in the early 2000s. There were these very serious campaign teams of PR professionals, lobbyists, people who had very serious and important backgrounds in communications. And now, you know, that team has to also include one verified millennial, you know, who's grown up on Snapchat and on Facebook and on Twitter and the apps that us olds aren't even allowed to know about.
And it goes without saying, but we'll say it anyway, you can't purposefully create a meme.
Well, you can, but seldom do those purpose-built memes where somebody at an ad agency says, we're going to make X thing funny so that we can promote Y idea about Z, our client. Those things don't tend to work. Once in a while they do, and we're duped into thinking that something was naturally viral when instead it was constructed, and we tend to feel resentful or as if we've been tricked. But the authentic stuff, it just like Chuck Grassley's tweets, right? Do you follow Senator Chuck Grassley?
Only because those tweets are outrageous.
You know, politics aside, I wish I could vote for the guy because his outsider weirdo tweets are the best. Do you have one handy?
Let me look. Yes. Thought my followers might like this pork recipe from Mrs. Grassley. And then I think he's also on Instagram because here's an Instagram picture. Oh, that's funny. Pork belly politics. Yep, there it is.
It's really hard to convey how outsider humor funny Chuck Grassley's Twitter stream is, but it's a great example of somebody using social media very, very badly as somebody who's older, not really accustomed to this medium, this vernacular, and stumbling into it in such a confident way. People think it's funny and endearing because it's just so darn weird. I think with Hillary Clinton releasing the sort of opening salvo for her campaign via social media, I think that's a completely different kind of thing. Nothing Hillary Clinton does is accidental, including social media. And the message that really sends is, young people, vote for me.
Yeah. Well, do young people buy that? Do they care if it's crafted or not?
I think with the inevitable coming onslaught of that kind of casual communication between a presidential candidate and her possible supporters, you know, the more that chatter builds up in the atmosphere, if you will, it's not just that like one stunt is going to work or not. It's the fact that this person speaks to us via a medium that's native to us. And I think that's ultimately what reads.
Okay. Let's move on to a nifty piece of gadgetry, Roomba. This is the robot vacuum.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have one.
I've never
have a dog, so you don't really need one.
Yeah.
But they're creating a Roomba lawnmower, which I could see, you know, could really be a horror movie or quickly outdated because we're ripping out our lawns.
In California, that's very true. So Roomba, these little circular vacuums that have been out for, I don't know, 10 years or so, they just could sort of bonk around the house like earthbound UFOs, sucking up the dust and hair off your floor. The company that makes them, iRobot, is developing sort of like a self-driving lawnmower to mow lawns. I could imagine this being very useful, say, on golf courses or on the expansive, lush estates of very wealthy people who do not live in California, where there's plenty of water to water your lawns. But the interesting thing about this how do you control a self-driving lawnmower so that it doesn't drive off your lawn and mow other people's lawns or mow down people? You do that by creating basically like a wireless fence, sort of like the wireless fences that we have for,
animals.
For dogs or animals. And you use radio frequency communication for that. So you use short-range radio to talk to the vacuum cleaner and say, only go to this perimeter, do not go beyond that perimeter. Astronomers hate it. Specifically, the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. So this is like our federal astronomy elite group. They're saying that they're very upset about this because the frequency that iRobot wants to use in these devices competes with the frequency that's used to operate some very large, very important telescopes that are searching for certain kinds of gas way, 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 way out there in the far reaches of the galaxy that indicate the presence of forming stars.
You're kidding.
So this is a robot vacuum versus telescope war.
Who's going to win?
Broken out on the 6240 to 6740 megahertz Lawnbot spectrum, and the FCC, the most boring agency of them all, is the arbiter of this
dispute.
Oh, yeah.
How close does it need to be to disrupt their frequency?
Was it like 55-mile exclusion zone claimed by the astronomers, 12 miles claimed by iRobot. So we're talking about a difference of, 43 miles or something?
Yeah.
It's an interesting conundrum and one that doesn't affect you or I.
No.
I think these devices are going to be expensive, and the idea of maintaining such a vast lawn in our current drought is ridiculous. But for people in other parts of the country, this could be... look, everything is going the way of self-driving. Mm, our cars,
exactly.
Our drones.
I say just get a couple of goats. Solve the problem.
Right?
Right?
And then you have your organic goat milk that you can...
No, goats.
Yeah.
Solution to all ills.
Is this show called Portlandia now?
I hope not.
Okay.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of boingboing.net. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Madeline.
So what do you think? Goats, yay or nay? No. Do politicians have to be internet cool to win elections now? How much of a role does a politician's social media presence play in your opinion of them? We want to know. Call us 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, last year wasn't real. This year is the view of the drought from farmers, some of whom say they'll go out of business if they don't get more water this summer. That story after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Last year, our holding pond dried up for the first time. We've been doing this 27 years. And we went for 8 weeks without a drop of water. And it was everything we could do just to keep our orchard alive.
Don Birch is a farmer in Three Rivers, California, about 200 miles north of L.A. We've talked a lot lately on the show about the impacts of California's drought and the state's new water restrictions. Today, we're going to hear from farmers, starting with Birch. She and her husband grow more than 100 kinds of produce. KCRW producer Saul Gonzalez spoke with her yesterday at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where she has a weekly booth. Birch and her husband are in their 60s, and she says in her nearly three decades in the business, she's never faced such a shortage of water.
We actually had to take out many of our apple trees because they require too much water. We're doing a whole bunch of things this year because we believe that all three of the rivers in Three Rivers will dry up this year. It's actually worse than last year. One thing we had to do was build a deer fence around our entire property. Because when the hills don't turn green, the deer go where they need to get food.
And that's your farm. But
that's our farm, yeah. We planted five different times and they ate 100% of it. And we also now, there's no overhead watering. going on, because that evaporates. Even our
You're talking about sprinklers.
Yeah, none of that goes on anymore. And even our drip lines, which we used to lay on top of the soil, we now bury them about 2 inches below the soil. So it drips out of the plastic line right on the root.
If this drought continues, heaven forbid, what do you think happens to you? I mean, do you just change the kind of things you grow? Do you stop growing certain things completely? Do you just leave the business? What?
We're not going to leave the business, okay? This is what we do, and we'll get more creative if we have to. I think the real trick being a farmer is not to let it make you crazy. But if this continues, like my husband said, the Central Valley is 150 years of farming a desert. And maybe it's just reached the end of its farming life cycle.
That was KCRW producer Saul Gonzalez speaking with farmer Don Birch of Three Rivers, California. I recently spoke with another farmer, Sean Coburn. He grows almonds, wine grapes, tomatoes, and other crops on 3,500 acres in Fresno, Madera, and Merced counties. He's also had to let some of his crops go because of the drought.
Cantaloupes, corn, wheat, alfalfa. I had pomegranates, so we let those go, let those die. So this year our focus is to keep our trees and vines, our permanent crops, alive, and if we have potential to supply some of our tomato contracts to the canneries, we're going to try to do that.
So you want to keep your almonds alive because they're a high-value crop as well, right?
Oh, everything up right now. Commodity prices are really good. And, you know, of course, if you let the tree die, you got to start all over again. But I do know some farmers that have some older trees that they're letting them go, just because it's not economically feasible for them to buy really expensive water or drill really expensive wells to keep 20-year-old almond trees alive.
Mm. So how do you get your water?
Well, currently we farm in three counties in the Central Valley, Fresno, Madera, and Merced. And everything that I have in Madera County is a 0% water allocation. And about 60% of everything in Fresno County is at a 0% allocation, the remainder being at around 40%. But that's still in the air because the State Water Resources Control Board is still pending a decision whether we're going to stay at 40% or we're going to go to possibly zero there. And the only reason we have water in that area is because it's a senior water rights district.
What would happen if you got cut to zero there?
Well, that's why we're waiting to plant tomatoes. If we go to zero, we won't plant anything, and we'll try to keep the other areas that are already at zero. We'll just try to keep trees and vines alive by buying water on the open market and pumping groundwater with wells that are functioning. We have wells now that they're breaking down.
Do you know why they're breaking down?
Oh, it's not a mystery. I mean, it's, the stuff just breaks, and then there's so much demand for well work right now that, you know, you have to get in line and wait for somebody to show up. It may take 3 weeks, it may take, you know, 2 months. I know if you wanted to drill a new well, you'd probably be 16 months out.
Wow. So how long have you been pumping the groundwater?
It depends on where you're at. We have areas where traditionally, historically, we pump groundwater a little bit every summer. And those areas, the groundwater levels are pretty much stable. In the areas that are at zero allocation, for the second year in a row, it's going to be a pretty big problem because we're going to have 2 full years of pumping a lot of groundwater. I can't say 100% because I'm still buying water on the open water market. In fact, I've actually outbid cities. We bought a block of water. I believe the city of Santa Barbara was trying to purchase. We actually outbid them.
Really? How much did you pay for it?
We paid about $1,800 a foot for it.
So $1,800 for an acre foot.
For an acre, yeah, $1,800 for 325,000 gallons of water. Well, that's what water's trading for out here when there isn't any, you know, and we're competing against, you know, cities and other high-value crops for a very scarce amount of water that's there.
Who's selling you the water?
It's just bits and pieces. Guys mm-hmm. have saved some water from the previous year that didn't grow anything. The majority of it is guys that just haven't grown anything, and they let their employees go. And they're going to sit around and wait and see, you know, and I don't blame them. to try to sell their water for the highest amount that they can get.
Okay, so you're buying water, you're pumping water. When it comes to pumping water, and you said, well, it's going to cause some problems. I mean, we've heard that it is actually destabilizing the ground, that it's destabilizing the permanent water table.
Yeah, it causes subsidence. There's a potential to cause subsidence, and subsidence is a big issue because when you deplete an aquifer to the point to where it collapses and the ground falls, you don't get that back.
So do you feel responsible for that?
No, I don't have any other choice. What do I do? Those almond trees and wine grapes, they pay for to keep my family and all my relatives fed and keeps all my employees and 401ks and insurance plans and their house payments and their kids in college. Wait, what do you want us to do? Starve? What do we do? I mean, we have no other choice.
Yeah.
There is a shortage of water this year, that's for sure. There's no doubt about that. And I'm my favorite joke about a farmer is, you know, what's the difference between a puppy and a farmer?
I don't know.
Well, eventually the puppy will grow up and quit whining. Farmers whine all the time. And they whine when it's sunny, it needs to be rainy. When it's rainy, it needs to be sunny, blah, blah, blah. I'm not whining about this. This is a very simple, simple problem to fix. In 1977, we went through a much more severe drought than we did last year, and yet we were still able to manage to deliver water to everyone in the state. Nothing's changed. People blame Southern California for using too much water. Southern California, they're awesome. They do a great job. You guys have 3 years worth of water stored down there. You guys are great. You guys learned from the drought. And it's a city like Sacramento that in August of last year ran out of water. I mean, they're surrounded by water. How smart are they? Everybody that's sort of anti-farmer comes out and says ag uses 80% of the water. Ag doesn't use 80% of the water. I've been in, people said, well, the governor cut everybody by 25% and he didn't cut ag. Well, what part of zero doesn't anybody understand? I mean, when we go like negative 25?
Yeah. Well, I think some people are saying, well, why are we growing things like rice? Why are we flooding fields with water instead of using drip irrigation in some cases?
I will tell you this. I'm 100% drip, and I'm not going to pick on any other farmers. Rice is a water-intensive crop, but so is double cropping fresh market tomatoes for Whole Foods, and I do that. He uses just about the same amount of water as rice. So, I mean, you got to look at it this way. Now, you don't have to, but I look at it this way. This is better. I look at it this way. It's debatable. People start breaking things down into gallons. I think 5-6 years ago, I'm not trying to take credit for it, but I think I was one of the first guys to ever tell a reporter, hey, you know, one almond is a gallon of water. I wish I'd never said that now because people are like, well, almonds are evil. Well, one cantaloupe, 60 gallons of water. You know, a bottle of wine is 275 gallons of water.
Well, so who do you blame? You say that this is a simple problem to fix.
You'd have to change some laws and the laws are what are now are hamstringing or core the way that we operate the state and federal water projects in California.
Which laws are those?
Well, you have a myriad of different ones, probably the biggest one being the Endangered Species Act.
Mm-hmm.
You have invasive species in the Delta being striped bass that eat a protected fish, salmon, yet we can't do anything about the striped bass, even though they're non-native.
But you think that changing those rules protecting those animals, that would fix the water problem?
That's why we don't pump water.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, I mean, you know, if I'm sitting in Southern California and they're telling me to yank out my lawn, I don't feel so sorry for the homeowner. I feel sorry for the people in the industry that provides, you know, lawnmowers and edgers and people that do it. They're mm-hmm. all going to lose their jobs.
So what do you think? I mean, do you think that you can continue doing this for a couple years or just this year?
No, this is. I thought last year I was going to be surprised if we could make it through, but this will be it for this year. If we don't catch a wet winter and we can't get some policy changed, you know, you're going to start seeing. Last summer we saw some bad stuff, but it was just targeted here and there. People that ran out of water, stuff. This year it'll be. This because there really isn't any water. We're in an actual real drought.
So you're saying that if you don't get a wet winter, you're going to be out of business? You're going to sell your farm?
Well, I don't know if there'll be any very many takers to sell. But, you know, it's hard to sell tumbleweeds. So, yeah, there'll be a little bit left. We do farm in an area that has a little bit more senior water rights.
But you'll get out of the business?
The majority of the stuff that I have will die, yeah. I just won't have any water, so it'll die.
Do you really think that's going to happen?
I got 1,650 feet of water left in my San Luis account. That's it.
And how long does that last?
So hopefully it gets me through July.
And so you've been doing this for a couple of decades.
Yeah.
And so how do you feel about that?
Oh, I mean, I've never seen so much stress and anxiety, you know, and I'm sort of young for being a farmer. I'm 46, you know. I've never seen so many guys so stressed out, not just farmers, but, you know, guys that are running ranches that, you know, their primary language is speaking Spanish, and, you know, they make good money. You know, they're making $100,000+, and they're looking around going, you know, if this thing goes away, you know, where in the hell am I going to get a job? You know, with the skill set I have, I know how to grow things. I know how to repair equipment. You know, I know how to run almond shakers. But with that skill set, how do you take that skill set and roll over the Tehachapis and find a job that'll pay you $100,000 a year?
What are you going to do?
I'll be fine. I mean, I'll do something. I'll have a little bit of ground left that'll still be farmable. You know, I'll manage. I'll get by. Am I going to be a little upset? Yeah. I mean, it's the first piece of dirt that anybody ever in my family ever bought. I was the guy that bought it, and it'll all be gone. So it'll suck.
Yeah. Well, Sean Coburn, farmer in the Central Valley, thanks for joining us today.
You got it.
And coming up on the show, we're going to talk about one of the things that really bothers Sean Coburn. The Delta smelt. It's on the verge of extinction. We'll find out more about that next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. Well, just before the break, we heard from farmer Sean Coburn about how hard it's been for him to get enough water to keep his farm alive.
The laws are what are now are hamstringing or the way that we operate the state and federal water projects in California.
Which laws are those?
Well, you have a myriad of different ones, probably the biggest one being the Endangered Species Act.
There's a tension that's getting more heated every day between farmers who want more water and environmentalists who want to protect endangered species in the San Joaquin Sacramento River Delta. One of those endangered species is the Delta smelt, a pinky-sized fish found in the Delta that's nearing extinction. Wildlife scientists earlier this month found a single Delta smelt remaining in the Delta. Peter Moyle joins us now. He's a wildlife biologist at UC Davis, and he's been studying the Delta smelt for more than 40 years. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, really, only one smelt?
Well, it was one smelt in a sampling program that's designed to capture smelt. So there no doubt are more smelt out there, but it was... This is a sampling program that is specifically designed to catch Delta smelt when they're aggregating for spawning. Now, spawning is just about over with, so you would expect numbers to be less, but certainly no one would have anticipated catching just one smelt.
Right. So how dramatic is this decline, and how long has it been going on?
Well, the decline really started in the 1980s. You know, it was listed as an endangered species in 1997, so that tells you that in that period of time that the decline was pretty dramatic. And it's kept going down since then. In recent years, the numbers have been extremely low, and this year the numbers are at record lows, the lowest they've ever been.
And is that because of the drought?
The drought has probably contributed to it because the Delta smelt decline is caused by a whole bunch of factors that are interacting all together, and the drought just makes everything worse because there's less fresh water in the system. The Delta doesn't work the way Delta ecosystem doesn't work quite the way it should, so it just has become a less favorable environment for the smelt. So if you're already on the ropes, which the smelt was, this is just one more punch that makes it difficult for them to recover.
And is it just the smelt, or are there others threatened by this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Basically, other species of E. coli are also threatened. The longfin smelt, for example, is at record low numbers as well. The winter-run Chinook salmon, the spring-run Chinook salmon are also not doing well. And, of course, for them, it's upstream as well as Delta conditions. green sturgeon are another species that's in trouble. So there's a bunch of species out there that are suffering because of the conditions.
Well, we just heard from farmer Sean Coburn, who is saying that this is a big problem for him, that we have all these laws protecting these fish and other animals. What do you make of what he said?
Well, you know, I can certainly understand where he's coming from, because at times the endangered species do reduce the amount of water available to be sent to farmers in the Southern Central Valley. But, you know, a majority of the water that's used in the Delta that people complain about is just being wasted out to sea is, in fact, water that's released to keep the Delta as a freshwater system. And it needs to be fresh water to support farming in the Delta itself, because the Delta farmers get their water directly from the channels next to their land. It also protects the intakes of the major pumps, like that of the East Bay Municipal Utility District and the big pumps in the South Delta, that are sending water to both farms and people. So the endangered species have played a role in this, but it's not nearly the role that they're generally blamed for.
Yeah, well, do you think that there's a way to adjust what's happening to maybe make it easier on farmers, but also to protect the animals?
Well, the fact is we're in a drought and the water supplies are at record lows. So the fish would be stressed anyway just because of the drought. But here they have all these additional factors that are working against them as well. So I think everybody's suffering together. And to me, the environment is another part of the total picture in California that has to be taken into consideration when you're making water decisions. We made a decision a long time ago that we don't want any species to go extinct, and that we don't want the commercial fisheries for salmon to disappear. So there's got to be sacrifices on both ends.
Yeah, I guess some people would say, well, when we're in a crisis like we are now, maybe the Delta smelt has to go away.
Well, it probably is,
yeah,
for better or worse. And that's because we haven't done enough for it in the past, partly because we haven't known quite what to do, and there are so many different things affecting it. But that tells you that when it comes to water for fish, the fish have generally been the losers.
You have a smelt hatchery at UC Davis, I understand.
Yes, it's actually a facility associated with the big pumping plant at Byron.
Uh-huh. And so is that it for the smelts, your hatchery?
Yeah, it's basically a backup in case the Delta smelt go extinct in the wild. So they, in theory, could be reintroduced if appropriate conditions return. It was established about 15 years ago when there was concern the smelt would go extinct, and obviously that seems to be coming true. And they also needed the source of fish to use for experiments. If you want to determine what the physiological requirements of the smelt are, what salinity can it live in, what temperatures can it live in, you need experimental fish. And there are so few fish in the wild that was thought raising fish in captivity would be a way to provide those fish. But it's basically a backup population for the wild fish.
Yeah. And so do you think that now it's not a backup anymore, that it's now the thing, and
well, the Delta smelt are not extinct yet. There are still a few hanging in out there. There's been some reports of some larval smelt, the really early life history stages. The one smelt that was caught was a spawned out fish. So presumably there has been some spawning taking place. The question is, when you get that few fish in the system, can their young survive, given all the things that happen to baby smelt and baby fish of any time? It's generally the toughest time in their life history when everything wants to eat them.
So how do they fit into the food chain? And if they're gone, how does that affect it?
Well, it doesn't affect the ecosystem much at all, because, you know, the Delta smelt's been effectively extinct as a major participant in the ecosystem for 20 years, and especially in the last few years, because there's so few of them. It hasn't been an important prey for other fish, and it hasn't affected the plankton populations in any way. So it's a species that if it disappears, the ecosystem won't miss it, except, of course, it's a tragedy because it's a species found only in the Delta.
Peter Moyle, biologist with UC Davis, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Myers is here with the listener feedback. Hello.
I am in the KCRW Basement River Delta with listener feedback, not endangered. Thank God.
Never endangered.
So we talked about Etsy today. They started trading on the NASDAQ. As of today, they went public. We asked our listeners about the weirdest stuff that they've seen on Etsy, and I lied. It wasn't endangered. Nobody bit. Nobody
what?
Bit on that question. And so I went on a fishing expedition for the... I'm horrible.
Stop it now.
I know. Sorry, Delta Smile. Anyway, I went on a search for the craziest stuff on Etsy. I found a baby made out of gumballs, which was pretty fun.
Real gumballs?
Real gumballs. They're probably stale at this point, but there was a fake mustache made out of actual human hair, which is maybe the creepiest thing I saw on there, though I'm not sure. There was also...
I will wager there's more creepy that we can't talk about on air.
That was actually some of it as well. I also found Lady Gaga embroidered toilet paper. Etsy, ladies and gentlemen. One time I started an Etsy shop as an experiment, and I was just going to sell a bunch of photos. And I was like, this is going to be so super successful, and I'm not even going to have enough time to fill all the orders. And then the crickets started.
What were the photos?
They were just stuff that I've, you know, took
art
all
photos.
Over the world.
Okay.
Art photos that people would hang up in their living room. I mean, I don't even have them hung up in my living room. I did this as a work assignment, but it was one of the more demoralizing things that I've had to do in the recent past. Not demoralizing were your responses to our segment about politicians trying to be internet cool. Christopher Breyer on Facebook says the internet has been horrible for politics. He says he doesn't care if a politician is media savvy or eloquent or shares my taste in music. I don't care if he or she is a person I'd want to have a beer with. All I care is that they can balance their intellect and empathy in a way that allows them to make great policy. Memes be damned.
Okay, thank you for that high-minded response. Julie Myers, thank you.
Of course.
And if you want to talk about anything you've heard on the air, we'd love to hear from you. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney and his fine show, To the Point, is up next. So stay right here. I'm Madeline Brandt. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.